You're listening to True Crime Feed. Welcome to True Crime Feed. I'm your host, Angela Ferrari, here to review the best true crime podcast from the past decade with a teensy bit of humor, plus my top three true crime picks of the week. Today on the docket, an interview from the archives I think you will really enjoy. Let's discuss the case for Errol Morris Goes to Nub City. A conversation with the famous true crime director that took place back in 2020 on the podcast Criminal, where we learn about the one documentary Errol Morris was too scared to finish. Ooh, I'm going to leave it at that for now. To take your listening experience to the next level, go to thetruecrimefeed.com and sign up for my newsletter where I curate visual aids to accompany the show. Here you will see photos of this infamous town, plus some colorful characters who did whatever they had to in order to survive. Okay, so have you also become so jaded where every time you hear mention of someone taking out a life insurance policy on their spouse, your first thought immediately goes to true crime? Yeah, same. And I'm gonna blame most of that on Dateline. Listening to Dateline for the past 10 years has turned me into one of those Pavlov experimental dogs, and now when I hear the word spousal protection insurance, I think, motive for murder. But I mean, how many of these stories have we heard where the promise of an insurance payout led someone to commit a horrendous crime? These scandals drop so frequently they don't even feel special or noteworthy anymore. Like a track from DJ Khaled.
Another one.
Already? Again? This one sounds exactly the same as the last four, major key. But then, I came across a story of insurance fraud I will never forget. It will live rent-free in my brain forever. It's dark and disturbing and explores the depths of human desperation. Like a Meatloaf song. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you may even need to call your therapist and make an appointment. A story that's equal parts absurd and inevitable, and we have the podcast Criminal to thank. Which is funny, because this didn't really start out like a standout episode of Criminal. It felt more like a boilerplate celeb interview format at first. Phoebe Judge hands the reins over to legendary filmmaker Errol Morris and lets him wax poetically about his many documentaries. His most famous being The Thin Blue Line, a must-watch for any true crime aficionado about a wrongful conviction. Not only did this film influence the courts and eventually lead to an exoneration, it was also just a gorgeous film. Hauntingly beautiful. However, my personal favorite Errol Morris film is called Tabloid, the story of a Southern beauty queen named Joyce McKinney who was accused of kidnapping and sexually assaulting a man. And let's just say Joyce tells a different story. You guys, if you haven't seen this documentary, Tabloid, watch it immediately so you can understand the context behind the following Joyce McKinney quote.
That's like trying to stuff a marshmallow in a parking meter.
Yes, she's crazy and probably guilty, but I could watch hours of this woman on my TV screen. Less of a fun watch? Errol Morris also made the film Standard Operating Procedure about the military prison Abu Ghraib. Yeah, that one was a challenge to get through. In fact, all three of his U.S. military-related docs were rough watches, but worth the viewing. Because Errol Morris, he goes there, man. He will take on any subject and ask the toughest of tough questions. The man has moxie. So I was shocked to hear that there was a subject Errol Morris was too scared to cover. But there was. And you just know a story this bizarre and twisted could have only occurred in one place. Take a wild guess. That's right, the Florida Panhandle. Inland from the beaches, about halfway between Tallahassee and Mobile, Alabama, you'll find a little town called Vernon. And when I say little, I really mean it. Just over 700 people live there. But for such a tiny town, Vernon had quite a bit going on. A couple of diners and barbecue joints, at least 10 churches, mainly of the Baptist and Pentecostal varietal. Oh, and after a quick look on Google Maps, I noticed that they have a family-friendly hog hunting club. But it wasn't hog hunting that originally brought folks to Vernon. It was the river. Holmes Creek. Tribes like the Podunks, the Nipmucks, and the Mohegans would pass through and camp along the creek. Then white settlers set up a trading post along the river, and it became a shipping stop in the 1880s. And the hot ticket item of commerce was gopher tortoise shells. These things used to fetch a pretty penny back then, and the tortoises were abundant in Vernon. The shells were used to make jewelry like earrings, brooches, and then also eyeglasses. And the tortoise business brought more permanent settlers to the area. The town of Vernon was incorporated in 1927, but the time of prosperity did not last. The Great Depression hit in the 1930s, demand for the shells fell, and boats stopped coming down the river. Poor folks in the South started referring to these once-prized gopher tortoises as Hoover chickens, a mockery of President Hoover's election speech promising a chicken in every pot just a year before the market crashed. Gopher tortoises were some of the only meat available for folks, easy to catch because they were slow moving. And soon those tortoises were on the verge of extinction. The poor folks stuck in Vernon, Florida would need to find another way to survive. Some drove an hour away to work at a factory. Others were able to eke out a living farming or harvesting timber. But the land in Vernon wasn't great. It was still too close to the ocean for it to be very fertile. It was pretty sandy and dry. Hardly anyone could compete with the large commercial farms and their expensive equipment. So living off the land in Vernon was nearly impossible. You'd be lucky if you could chase down a possum or wrestle a raccoon for your dinner. While many other parts of the country post-World War II were forging ahead and finding prosperity, Vernon, Florida remained stuck in poverty. The kind of poverty where more than half of its citizens were receiving welfare aid. The kind of poverty where a normally horrific occurrence anywhere else would be cause for celebration in Vernon. Now, keep in mind, the names and specific details of the following cases were not made public. We have, of course, plenty of town gossip and the word of a handful of insurance agents who dared to investigate. Here's how they say things unfolded. It began in the late 1950s. A local Vernon man was hunting and accidentally shot his foot, which needed to be amputated. Normally, a terrible thing. But this fella happened to have an insurance policy that paid out a few thousand dollars in the event of an accidental dismemberment. His neighbors took notice, and soon there were other, quote, accidental dismemberments. Insurance regulations were more lenient back then. Hunting was also more lenient and much more dangerous back then. Accidental shootings or fallings or any other assortment of various injuries were more common, and it took a lot longer to get the victim to emergency medical care. Hunting was how a lot more folks got their food back then, so more hunting equaled more mishaps. So insurance companies created and marketed policies specifically for hunters. And a few Vernon men took out specialized short-term recreational insurance policies just before going on hunting trips, you know, in case there were any accidents. And we'll never know exactly what happened in those woods, but we do know there were more men from Vernon returning home from hunting trips maimed and receiving payouts. As the money started flowing, other Vernonites found ways to increase their payouts. Hunting insurance policies yielded fairly small amounts considering. But taking out life insurance with clauses for accidental injury, yeah, they cost more money, but they yielded a much greater compensation. It was all about finding that balance between quality of life and being set for life financially. Gouging out your eyes might be taking it too far, but hell, losing a toe or two? A small price to pay to keep food on the table. Losing a couple of fingers might feed your family for a year, but the real money came from losing a limb. But honestly, who would do such a thing? It seems impossible to imagine. But come the 1960s, multiple dismemberment claims had been paid out exceeding more than $100,000, all in this one area of the panhandle. So, an insurance agent named John Healy was tasked to roll through Vernon and investigate. He would sit in his car in the sweltering heat and observe the townspeople. It didn't take him long before he started to notice a very specific pattern. Not only were several people in Vernon missing limbs, many of them were specifically missing their left hand just above the elbow or their left foot just below their knee. It was abundantly clear to John that this was no coincidence. There were men who worked at a factory for years, handling the same tools every day, now all of a sudden accidentally sawing off their hands, including three Vernon men who each lost a limb all using the same saw. Others who were longtime hunters, usually expert marksmen well-versed in handling firearms, somehow they inadvertently shot themselves or their friends in their non-dominant limb. Like the guy who shot himself in the foot protecting his chickens. Or the other guy who fortuitously blasted off his hand with a shotgun while he was supposedly aiming at a hawk. And all of these strange accidents happened to occur just after the victim purchased an insurance policy. And again, a lot of these people were out of work or living well below the poverty line, but they were still purchasing very expensive insurance policies. John Healy made the comment that, quote, Vernon's second largest occupation was watching hound dogs mating in the town square. Its largest was self-mutilation for monetary gain. And he wasn't the only one growing wise to the scheme happening in Vernon. An insurance agent named L.W. Birdshaw became sus after he sold a Vernon man a policy, and then 12 hours later, that guy mistakenly shot off his left foot because he, quote, saw a squirrel. L.W. also went on to sell another Vernon guy a 10-day hunting policy, but on the very first day, that man accidentally shot himself in the foot, too. LW was back at home at the dinner table when he got the news, and he didn't miss a beat, correctly guessing that the man shot off his left foot. And when his daughter asked how did he know it was his left foot, LW replied, because that son of a bitch is going to drive a Cadillac with his right foot. But things only got worse. There were people in Vernon losing two limbs. And as if that wasn't rare enough, they'd be losing limbs on opposite sides of their body. Again, how on earth does this happen? Well, one guy claimed he acquired these amputations from an accident that involved both a tractor and a gun. How unfortunate and unusual. But lucky for him, his insurance policy deemed that losing two limbs was so tragic that it resulted in a full life insurance payout. We're talking high six figures in 1960s money. That's a whole lot of Dixie beer and Gator gumbo. And when it came to this particular Vernon man, because these injuries happened to opposite sides of his body, he was able to use a crutch to get around and still drive a car and have full use of his dominant hand. And soon, other Vernon locals were involved in similar freak accidents that resulted in simultaneously losing two limbs on opposite sides of the body, then receiving a Cadillac load of money. At this point, insurance companies tried prosecuting what they believed to be fraudulent claims, but no jury would indict because they couldn't fathom the idea that people would actually do this to themselves. So the companies were forced to keep paying up. By 1970, more than two-thirds of the entire nation's dismemberment insurance claims were coming from this little dot on the Florida panhandle. Vernon, with its population of just over 700, at least 80 of those residents collected insurance payouts for losing a limb. And those in the biz had a nickname for Vernon. They started calling it Nub City. And referred to the residents who received payouts, members of the Nub Club. And perhaps the most egregious member of the club was the panhandle farmer who took out so much insurance. I'm talking over 20 separate policies that his bills exceeded more than his income. But lucky for him, just weeks later, he was able to claim millions after accidentally shooting off his left foot. He was also fortunate enough to have a tourniquet handy in his pocket. You know, in case of snake bites. Even more lucky, he drove the car with the automatic transmission out in the field that day, instead of his usual truck with the clutch. Despite a lengthy investigation into this Vernon man's slew of too-good-to-be-true coincidences, the insurance companies were obligated to pay this farmer over $1 million. This case was the turning point. It was glaringly apparent that insurance companies needed to change up their policies. The barrier to file claims became much higher and the payouts paltry. According to an article in the Tampa Bay Times, some insurance companies implemented a rule that they would not pay if the policyholder lost a hand or a foot within a year of signing the policy. Come 1972, it was nearly impossible for anyone in Vernon to get insured. In that same Tampa Bay Times article, an elderly Vernon woman claimed that when she tried to insure her home after her husband died, she was told, quote, "It couldn't be done. Not in this town." And so the money dried up in Vernon once again, and many folks were left with permanent scars. To make matters worse, now the press had gotten a hold of the story. The Nub City scandal was making the rounds in Florida and eventually the national press, attracting the attention of Errol Morris. In the late 70s, he gets word of this bizarre Florida phenomenon and decides to make a documentary about it. This subject was right in his wheelhouse. Errol made contact with insurance agent John Healy and revealed his plans to go to Vernon and get the full scoop. John Healy tells him that's a real bad idea. Vernon was dangerous. But Errol doesn't believe it, because when he checked the criminal records, he saw the murder rate was zero. So he rolls into town and makes contact with the Washington County Sheriff. Errol inquires about the low crime and murder rate in Vernon, and the sheriff remarks, "Down here, we don't have murders. We just have disappearances." All right, that's a little creepy. But Errol still chooses to continue with this project. He rents a little place in Vernon and starts going to the local watering holes, hoping to make connections with potential subjects for his future film. Let's just say he didn't get a very warm reception. I mean, in hindsight, what was this guy thinking? Errol Morris was from New York City. He went to a fancy private school in Vermont, then went to college at Princeton, eventually Berkeley. And now this young hotshot city slicker filmmaker rolls into Vernon, Florida, and thinks he's going to befriend the locals to the point where they're going to admit on camera to committing fraud. Yeah, that's not what happened. The only people he could get to talk were the insurance agents. The Vernon residents instead expressed their sentiment in other ways. One fella put his cigarette butt out on Errol Morris's lapel. And I don't want to victim blame and say wearing a suit jacket to the Florida Panhandle means you were asking for it, but come on, Errol, you gotta try a little man camouflage yourself. Literally, wear some camo. So no, Errol wasn't making friends or blending in, and things escalated when another Vernon man tried to hit Errol's cinematographer with his truck. It was only after Errol Morris got his ass kicked by a couple of locals that he decided he needed to take this project in a different direction. He abandoned the subject of investigating the insurance fraud altogether, and renamed his film from its original title, Nub City, to the more benign Vernon, Florida, where he interviews various quirky townspeople and captures a more lighthearted portrait of Vernon. In the film, there is zero reference or mention to the intentional dismembering events that made Vernon so famous. But even still, after the documentary came out, the folks in Vernon wanted nothing to do with the film or the attention it brought to their town. I do understand the opposition from the Vernon locals, but at the same time, I can't help but be fascinated by this place. It's a prime example of stranger than fiction. And my initial knee-jerk reaction was to laugh because this just seemed so implausible. But then there was a point in the story where it hit me that this was as real as human desperation gets. When I heard the following quote from the editor of the local paper down there who said, "You have to realize there was a time when these people ate possums because there was nothing else to eat. So you had to go out and run down a possum, plug them to death, and eat them. What do you need your left foot for? If you can cut it off, get $200,000 and not have to worry about chasing possums anymore." As dark as that statement is, in a weird way, I'm comforted by the fact that there is a clear-cut purpose for why these people did what they did.
Maybe clear-cut's the wrong choice of words there.
But you catch my drift. However misguided and messed up it was, we at least understand why this happened. And there's a saying often attributed to Mark Twain that goes, "Comedy equals tragedy plus time." When it comes to Vernon, Florida, though, I'm still getting the too soon vibe. So no, I won't feel right about laughing about Nub City until Vernon is able to laugh at itself. And that day seems a long way off still. So instead, I'm going to continue enjoying my favorite pastime of openly mocking those who desecrated their bodies with ugly, misspelled tattoos. Well, we made it out of Nub City in one piece. I know I'm terrible, but seriously, is this not the craziest story of insurance fraud you've ever heard? You're never gonna forget it. It's gonna stay with you, haunt you like a Meatloaf song. Let me know what you thought of this one. You can email me directly at angela@thetruecrimefeed.com or join the True Crime Feed Facebook discussion group. Keep an open mind and be kind to fellow True Crime Feed friends. Stay tuned till after the break to hear my top three podcast power ranking of the week. Ah, hey you. I'm so glad we found each other and get to share our special love for true crime podcasts. I don't ever want you to miss out on a wild story. That would be a crime in itself. So be sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on your podcast app and share your favorite episode with a friend so the next time you see each other, you can splurge about your latest true crime obsession. Thanks for spreading the word, and now back to the show. And we're back. Here are the three shows currently trending that I think are worth a listen. I present to you this week's podcast power ranking. At the number three spot, we have Serial Season 4. Here's a quick reminder from the show page. Serial returns with a history of Guantanamo told by people who lived through key moments in Guantanamo's evolution. Who know things the rest of us don't about what it's like to be caught inside an improvised justice system. All right, episode 5 was a hard listen, but a really good one. The tone is less juicy gossip and more of what I was expecting for a story about Guantanamo. A whole lot more suffering and agony. I am shocked by how candid this warden is being. You are hearing some incredibly compelling interviews on this season of Serial. At the number two spot, we have The Price of Paradise. Here's a summary from the show page. When ex-bunny girl Jane Gaskin spots the desert island of her dreams for sale online, she decides to risk it all. Trading in their English village home, the Gaskin family relocate to their own private paradise, just off the coast of Nicaragua. And a reality TV crew follows them to film a new show, No Going Back. But soon, they all discover that paradise has its secrets. The locals claim the island belongs to them, and it's being sold illegally. Jane's not leaving without a fight. A fight that will soon turn deadly. This is a Wondery show at its best. I think you will really enjoy this one. It's a fun ride so far. I've never heard a story like this one before. And I gotta give a whole lot of credit to the host, Alice Levine. Her storytelling is perfection. She's effortlessly charming and funny. Even the way Alice pronounces Nicaragua in her fancy British accent is adorable. Honestly, I'm super jealous and would like to sit and stew in my feelings of podcast host envy, but I'm too busy enjoying the show. It's unwind true crime with an addictive story, and I also feel like I'm getting a deeper understanding of Nicaraguan culture. Win-win. The price is right when you tune in to The Price of Paradise. And at the number one spot, you already know, we have Beyond All Repair. Here's a rundown from the show page. Imagine you're accused of something horrific. You swear you didn't do it, but someone says they witnessed it. Your own brother. Sophia Johnson was newly married with a baby on the way when she became the prime suspect in her mother-in-law's brutal murder. Host Amari Stevenson re-examines a case unsolved, a family torn apart, and the woman who wasn't believed. Oh my god, you guys, episode 9, what the f***? Again, no spoilers, but I am bursting at the seams here. The first half of the episode when they're interviewing you-know-who, I was like, no way will I ever believe this narcissist. And then the second half, when the report comes out, I'm like, ugh, this changes everything. I need answers. And I think we're gonna get them in the final episode 10, but I also don't want this ride to end. It's been so amazing listening to Beyond All Repair. Now for my miss of the week. We have Murder on My Mind. Here's a synopsis from the show page. Jamel Demons, also known as the up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly, gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for both his shocking lyrics and his criminal exploits. Although he's never denied his past convictions, Melly adamantly denies any involvement in the gruesome murders of two of his best friends in 2018. This show comes to us from Wondery, and this is an example of Wondery at its worst. And I'm bummed because normally a story that combines hip-hop and true crime would be right up my alley, but not this story. For starters, this case is very much still ongoing. Melly's awaiting his second trial after the first one ended in a hung jury. So the case is in a holding pattern, and that's what this podcast feels like. A boring slog. Not to mention they're keeping most of the episodes behind a paywall with no release date in sight, and this strategy seems to only be making any potential listeners infuriated. That's why I've got the podcast queue trapdoor on my mind for murder on my mind. Find out next week if Beyond All Repair will remain in the number one spot as the series concludes, or if a new show will swoop in and take its place. Let me know what trending shows are in your top three and what show fell through your podcast queue trapdoor. I'll meet you back here next week to dust off another superb true crime show from the archive for your next feeding fix. That's all for today's true crime feed. Don't forget to sign up for my weekly newsletter where I post links to my top three favorite shows of the week and bring you fabulous visual aids for every episode. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook to join the conversation. And if you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review and tell your fellow partners in crime to tune in to True Crime Feed. It's truly a huge help to grow the audience, and it means the world to me. So thank you so much for riding along and allowing me to be your audio accomplice. Join me next week for another feeding.